Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Shortcoat Podcast.
Welcome back to the Shortcoat Podcast. It is I, Dave Etler, and though you are no doubt suitably impressed by that, it would be terribly boorish of me not to point out my co-hosts this week, each of whose images I ran through a celebrity look-alike generator to find the male and female celebrities they most resemble. I thought it would be nice to give people a sort of visual impression of who they're hearing from today. So, it's with great pleasure that I say I'm joined by Corbin Weaver, who is a 77% match for Jerry Springer. I'm sorry, 78% match for Elton John and a 74% match for Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Those are very different things.
It's very accurate.
newbie, Casey McCleary is here. Hi, Casey.
Hi.
Thank you for joining us. She's a 77% match for Jerry Springer and a 71% match for Cameron Diaz.
Lies.
Is it a glasses thing?
I don't know. Lisa Weir is in the hizzy and also is a 76% match for Bruce Willis and an 82% match for Laura Linney.
Dang it, I was hoping for Emma Stone.
Yeah.
I know.
I was too.
That's ambitious.
Greg Woods is here. He looks about 72% Ray Liotta and 71% Drew Barrymore.
That's the best one so far.
I'll embrace that.
Take that one. That's
nice. Living the dream.
Ben Quarshi is here. Did I pronounce that right, Ben?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah.
Ben Quarshi, he's new. He's here for the first time. He reminds us all of 87% Kevin Spacey and 81% really? Queen Elizabeth II. And Cole Chaney is back as a 91% Ooh. Match with...
I got an A.
Anybody want to take a hazard a guess? Mm-hmm. Who does he 91%?
Wait, so you're saying it's kind of accurate?
I don't know. I'm not making any 91% match with Dwayne Johnson, The Rock.
The Rock.
Ooh.
And an 83% match with Alec Baldwin.
Okay.
You were the only one for whom a female match was apparently impossible.
It's that beard?
We were talking about the bro pod with Lisa just the other day.
That is, if you skip me. Oddly, I match no higher than 71% for anyone. And Steven Spielberg is 71% me, and I'm 68% Tony Blair. Prime Minister.
Is this just a random name generator?
I don't know. I you know, like, I had
two heads of state.
I had high hopes for this. And, you know, after running through, you know, I was doing this like 5 minutes ago, and after running through these matches, I'm like, I don't think any of us look like who we were matched with. But if you want, if that helps our listeners, you know, get an image in their mind, accurate or not, for how we look, then good, if it makes them comfortable. Right? Don't you think?
Sure. I mean, we should do like a BuzzFeed quiz on everyone sometime. Yes.
Who? What?
Please?
What breed of dog?
What breed of dog are you?
What?
That's my favorite.
Is there a BuzzFeed quiz that we should?
My favorite BuzzFeed quiz is what BuzzFeed quiz are you?
I think my favorite was actually. Well, I mean, I like the dog one, obviously, but what random item are you?
Oh,
like what were some items? Like
I was
staplers?
A bag of black beans.
That is really
that's
random.
Obvious.
Yeah, I mean, I know, right? And then, I don't know, there are other things like, yeah, like a rock or a squirrel.
I'm the rock.
You are. That's probably your random item.
Ooh, and my Sprite just spilled all over.
Oh, jeez.
Party fail.
This might be my sign to go, because I actually, there's enough people here, I don't want to hog the mic. I just wanted to promote our internship.
Yes.
Dave.
Yes, we have posted an internship on hireahawk.com. It's open only, unfortunately, perhaps. Well, you know, it's open to University of Iowa students.
Yeah.
Undergrads and pre-meds. So go to hireahawk.com and look for the production assistant position for the coming spring.
We'd love to have you. We're looking for someone who can work 10 hours a week, I think.
Minimum 10 hours a week. 10. That's the like required minimum number of hours for an internship.
So basically the thought is Dave does a ton of heavy lifting behind the scenes here at the podcast. This high production quality does not come for free. Dave slaves away night and weekend to make this show happen.
If you've ever noticed how the quality sort of tails off at the end, especially when I'm ready to hit the music credits button, it's because I'm tired and I need help.
Yeah, so come and help. And we'd even love a little contribution from the pre-med opinion. There will be a speaking role. And that's all I have to promote, but we'd love to have some people send their application in.
That'd be fantastic.
Tweet it at me.
Yeah.
Wait, Cole, before you leave, what is your Twitter handle?
Oh, I don't have one.
What?
How can we see it?
What is your obsession with
Twitter?
Tweet
the Short Coat Podcast. It's the collective we here.
I was sure you had a Twitter handle because
you're have
in
one.
Love with it.
I do. No,
he does have one, but he doesn't use it.
It's like an infatuation with Twitter that I don't have one.
I actually did that for years where I just stalked on Twitter.
Yeah, so the silent observer, right?
Yeah.
But then, conscientious objector.
I tweet some now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's this interesting trend where you keep your deleted tweets, things that you've essentially tried to type and thought like, maybe it's not appropriate, and so you basically have this bin now of like B-minus jokes. So it's a draft folder I've heard on Twitter. I've heard some people doing this, more celebrities, and they go through and then they re-comb through and say, you know, that joke was not funny at all, or well, that was pretty good. Like, I had a good idea there.
I'll have to check that out.
I like this.
All right. Thank you for coming, Cole. You guys, everybody familiar with Brittany Maynard?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Sounds familiar.
Anyone not familiar? Here, hop into that seat. Oh, or not. But pull that microphone right up close to you if you can. There you go. Brittany Maynard died this past Saturday. Doctors had told Maynard she had 6 months to live last spring after she was diagnosed with a stage 4 glioblastoma.
Oh, she was a basketball player?
I don't know if
she was. That's a different one. She's still doing okay.
She subsequently became a rallying point, though, for the... what I'm going to call the death with dignity movement. She, knowing she would die, she moved from California to Oregon with her husband because of Oregon's Death with Dignity Act, and became sort of unofficial spokesperson, I guess, for it. 1997 Act allows for physicians to prescribe lethal medications to terminally ill patients, and I went and looked at their data. Just to give us some background on this, since the law was enacted, 1,173 people have received such prescriptions, and 752 have used them to end their lives. Comparing 1998 figures with 2013 figures, there's been a 262% increase in death with dignity deaths. So. I don't know. I thought we'd talk about this a little bit. What do you, as future doctors, what's sort of your opinion on this vis-a-vis do no harm and but helping your patients? What do we think about this? What have been your reactions this week reading about this?
I'm always kind of torn on this. I mean, I worked in the hospital as a nursing assistant for like 4 years, and I've seen some really unpleasant deaths, and I can see where people would want that and want to avoid that. But I also sometimes wonder, like, is this something that people maybe too hastily make, or if they're not in the right state of mind, or like, we never really can predict the future. So you don't know, like, maybe she would have gotten another 2 years. It's hard to tell.
Yeah, I mean, well, for if you don't know what glioblastoma is, it's a pretty miserable...
That one is a pretty bad one.
It's a pretty miserable...
diseases, I guess, would be more...
I mean, yeah, I mean, there's eventually, you're going to reach a gray area. And if you go through the spectrum of you know, horribleness to, you know, I don't know, not horribleness, glioblastoma is way on the horrible end, probably, right? It's... headaches, seizure, vomiting, trouble thinking, changes in mood and personality, vision problems are all features of glioblastoma, potentially speech problems. And the goal of treatment, unfortunately, with glioblastoma isn't cure, apparently, but remission. And it's very likely that it'll come back. But there's all sorts of illnesses out there that aren't quite as bleak, but which may be illnesses that people would consider taking their own lives because they have. Mm-hmm. So are some diseases more deserving? Are people with some diseases more deserving of others than choosing their right to live? Or choosing their right to die on their own terms?
Nobody wants to go first.
No, yeah. I've chosen an uncharacteristically...
what I will say is that regardless of what side of this you're on, it's definitely created a lot of conversation. It's brought this spectrum up and it's given a face to it, which I think in the past has maybe been a little bit lacking. And wherever this is going to go, this is a very important subject right now because we're only going to hear more and more about this, I think, given the publicity that it raised and the dilemma that it also brings up, both from a medical standpoint, but also from a person standpoint, from a religious standpoint, from whatever you want to look at it. It's definitely something that's going to get talked about quite a bit.
Yeah, and I feel like with regards to the do no harm component of this, a lot of people think of dying as being sort of the ultimate harm, but if you think of the struggle and the pain and the loss of self that people go through with some of these terminal illnesses, I can certainly see the argument being made that you're actually doing less harm by allowing someone to opt out of that process of losing everything slowly and painfully than to force them to go through it and sort of die a more natural death.
Right. I mean, we talk a lot about how, you know, there are different definitions of the good or what's, you know, what is harm exactly. And, you know, these are all culturally ascribed and and we're, you know, learning in our professional skills courses, actually, that, you know, you need to have a conversation with your patient about, like, what is their priority. And I actually just read an article and Atul Gawande actually has a new book out called Being Mortal about kind of end-of-life palliative care and how it's important that physicians have conversations with their patients about what is their good and what are they seeking with their care. And for some people, you know, fighting or, you know, pursuing that last treatment till the very end is what's important, regardless of what they're going to suffer. But for other people, life has a very specific meaning. Life means, you know, interacting with my family. Life means interacting socially. Life means getting up and moving around. And, you know, it's very individual. And, you know, you do have to draw a line as a government, some, you know, in many ways. But also, I think it's hard to set a firm stance on, you know, this person's life. You know, you have to follow it to the bitter end, or this person, you know, their priorities are different than mine. So it's interesting. And, you know, it's interesting because my grandmother actually died this summer from glioblastoma. And,
no kidding. I didn't know that. Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's fine. And she had it 15 years ago and it went to remission and it just came back. And we went the palliative care option. And just because it was likely that, you know, any treatment couldn't do anything for her. But I think, you know, that was her option. That was her choice. And I think we're all grateful for that.
Yeah, does Iowa have is this in Iowa? Because you're an Iowan.
Yep, I'm an Iowan.
Does Iowa have have any prohibitions against this?
I mean, she went the palliative care option, so I...
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so, I mean, it wasn't...
Yeah, I get it.
Yeah.
We don't do a very good job in this country of talking about death with patients.
Yeah.
I think in general. Isn't that the case?
Yeah, definitely agree.
I think... United States medicine in general has a history of being pro-life, like continuation of life, not necessarily how to manage incurable diseases.
We put a very high premium on life in this country, and sometimes at the expense of forgetting about the quality of that life.
That's true.
I think what's interesting about this whole discussion about, you know, not here today, but, you know, Brittany Maynard in particular, is that she's young. And I think a lot of times when you think of, you know, physician-assisted suicide, you're thinking of older people. At least I am thinking of older people, you know, who are, I mean, it's just a different story when you're talking about older people. But she was 27, really young. The other interesting thing about this, and that I've heard people talk about, or I've read people talk about, is that she's awfully pretty. Okay. And I bring this up because some people think, you know, oh, well, you know, if she wasn't that pretty, we wouldn't be getting this attention, or we wouldn't be paying this close attention to the issue. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like, you know, we only care about animals that are cute, you know, but, you know, the ugly animals, you know, just hit them with a hammer or something, you know, we don't care.
Right? I think just think it's the same sort of, you know, we have a bias towards attractiveness.
That's a good, because it was on CNN. I remember now. It made CNN, like the Britney
Yeah.
Thing. It was like a top there, right there. So,
and
you know.
And I've heard other people, of course, say that, well, that has nothing to do with it. But as long as it helps publicize the Death with Dignity movement, well, okay, we'll take it, you know. Any opinions about that?
It's interesting because this sort of thing has happened before. We've seen this in several cases in the past. I don't know when the first prominent one was, in the early 90s maybe was the first one, so 20-some years. And it's kind of been all over the board in terms of who has chosen to take that route, both in terms of disease circumstances and current state of quality of life, things like that. So it would be interesting to see, you know, how this does stick in terms of this particular case, or if, you know, 20 years from now it has the same sort of impact as the case that was back in 94, which I wish I remember the names in that, but it was a daughter who had also had a bone cancer, I believe it was, and she had pled with her mother to ask to end her life, which eventually she did. I think she was only 16 or 18, somewhere around there. It was. I wish I remember more about it, but again, very different circumstances, but the same topic that I think a lot of people have forgotten about because I don't know how many people would say, "Oh yeah, we've heard that before."
I think as doctors are making these choices, at least in the case of Brittany Maynard, you know, her doctor made her, you know, in Oregon, is permitted to make an assessment of, you know, the lethality of the condition and say, yeah, this is something I will support. So I think that's also an aspect of it that maybe we're not thinking, maybe some people aren't really thinking about. Mm-hmm. The doctor made the decision, you know, to allow this, to help this. And so it wasn't just like, you know, somebody saying, oh, I can't take it anymore. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the doctor was very torn. I heard a good interview with her where she talks about how Brittany, when asking for the medicine, told her that she could, you know, take some time and think about it. I know this is going to be hard for you, like hard for you to prescribe the medicine. And she did, and it was a big struggle because she really cared about this patient. And in the end, she decided this is what was best for the patient, that the patient knew what was best for herself.
We'll be back in just a second on the Short Coat Podcast.
Inside Stories is an oral narratives project that catalogs the stories of medical students during their journeys through medical school. The podcast is hosted on In Training, the online magazine for medical students. Visit us at in-training.org/inside-stories. Inside Stories is a founding member of Vocalis, the podcast network for medical students. Please listen to our partner podcasts at vocalisnetwork.wix.com/listen.
We're back. First of all, I want to take a minute or take a second to shout out to Twitter user Make Me a Med Student who tweeted at us yesterday that we should keep doing what we're doing. She listens. You know, we shouldn't change a thing. Ooh, so
yes,
awesome.
We're so desperate for for acknowledgement. Please,
we're doing something right.
Tweet at us. Before we continue with the show, my daughter wants to be on the show.
Yes,
I mentioned her on the show last week.
Yeah,
and so I played it for her yesterday when the show came out, and she said she wanted to be on the show. And I said, "Well, you can't because you're in school." But she really wants to, she tried to argue with me that she should, you know, get the day off to come in and be, I think she just wants to be famous because after all, people who are on the show, they're famous.
People tweeted us.
They do.
Legitimacy.
So, but I've decided to indulge her by asking her what it means to be a doctor. Skip ahead 2 minutes and 40 seconds if you hate beautiful children.
I'm here with 7-year-old Coraline, who desperately wants to be on the show. She will do anything to be on the show, including skip school, right?
Yes.
What does a doctor do?
He does medical care, and he sometimes helps people with cancer or sickness.
Are doctors friendly?
Yes. Yeah.
Who's your doctor?
I forget.
You forget? Yes. Dr. Jill?
Yes.
Well, that's okay. You can forget. It's fine. What's the nicest thing a doctor ever did for you?
Make me squeal.
Make you squeal?
Yeah, I got a shot, and oh. I squealed.
And that's the nicest thing they ever did?
Yeah, because that's the only thing I can remember.
Wow. How long do you think it takes to become a doctor? Like, what do they have to do to become a doctor?
They have to go to, like, medical school, and they have to study lots and lots of work.
What kind of things do they study?
They study... I don't really know what they study.
Come on, guess.
They study heart diseases and cancer.
Have you ever been sick?
Yes. And in fact, I have a cold right now.
And do you think a doctor can help you?
No, not really.
How come?
Because it's a cold, and coughing and sneezing isn't really what a doctor can really fix for you so much.
Yeah, that's sort of true. I mean, they could give you medicine, right?
Yeah, yes.
But you don't think that medicine would do you any good?
Well, not really, because it just stops coughing and sneezing because you're still sick.
That right there, that statement right there makes you more knowledgeable and more learned than most people on this planet. Do you realize that?
Yeah, pretty much.
Do you want to be a doctor when you grow up?
I don't know. I don't really have much choices of what I could be.
You mean you have choices, you just haven't figured out what you want to be when you grow up?
Yes.
Have you thought about jobs before?
Many times. Well, actually, just a few. Like astronauts and doctors and nurses and...
But are those jobs just for boys or just for girls?
No, not really.
Good. Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. Who is the cutest child in the universe?
I am.
You got that right. This is Dave Etler and Coraline signing off.
Bye-bye.
I am so indulgent.
Oh my god, that's like cuteness overload.
That yeah.
May and, well be the cutest child.
And FYI, her voice kind of sounds like Marcel the Shell.
Oh my god,
which
it's so true.
Extra adorable.
Anyway. Does anybody have any news they want to bring us this week?
I do, actually.
Sure.
All right, so as we progress through our lives and technology continues to get better and better, we have to do a bit of catch-up. And in one of these industries, especially the automotive industry, there's a lot of catching up to do as things are changing all the time. And one of those things, whether it be different tire compounds, different engine regulations, different fuel mixtures, perhaps the most intriguing is the size of the American stomach. Because right now, a new crash test dummy has come out that is supposed to simulate the average American obese person, because the crash test dummies that we have been using are much smaller. They're very petite. But as you may know,
the average is 140 pounds.
Correct. Yes. Yes.
Which
but
surprised me.
As you may have recognized, America is not that size. So these crash test dummies.
Every morning, I recognize this.
These crash test dummies have a BMI of around 35. They're weighing in at somewhere over 200 pounds.
270.
Yes.
270.
I thought it was like 130 something. 124 kilograms. So about 250 pounds. A little bit more than that. So anyway, the point is obese people tend to have more injuries and things in car crashes. So to keep up with that, this new company has said, well, we need to make a crash test dummy to see exactly what will happen so we can change our cars to accommodate for this.
They don't have any results or anything. Are we going to...
Not yet, not results.
We're going to see a raft of like cars being certified as like dangerous now?
They do have the crash test dummy, a picture of the new versus the old.
Oh my god, it's me.
There you go.
You don't wear that bright orange jumpsuit.
I do.
Well,
you
know,
have a problem with that?
It's like a t-shirt at the beach sometimes. You just have to.
I have a question. If we're like testing cars with large dummies and we change it for that, are small people going to have more injuries after this?
Do you have any concerns about this personally, Lisa?
Well, I mean, I'm not that small, but I'm not 250 pounds, so...
Maybe it's not not one, but both, sort of.
Yeah, I think they're going to do testing. I mean, they're not going to, like, just throw away the 140-pound.
No.
Yeah.
No, because another one of the concerns is in the bracket that gets injured a lot more heavily are the elderly, the older population, because obvious reasons with bone density and muscle mass, things like that. So they do have to keep that in mind as well. They want an overall safer car. And to do that, they need to take all of the different body styles into account. So I assume they would keep the smaller ones as well, just like they do children crash tests.
I wonder if these mannequins can have different bone densities, quote unquote, or like different. That would be cool.
A crash test dummy that thinks it's just big bone.
Well, no, I was thinking maybe to simulate an elderly person.
Oh,
or,
that's a good idea. Maybe what'll come out.
It is a good idea. Patent. Like, I'm patenting it.
You know, you mentioned children, like they have different sizes of car seats for children. Mm-hmm. Maybe you'll be able to like get different sizes seats for your car. Like I could exchange the seats in my car for seats that are better for me.
Yeah, like when you gain weight, you have to buy new pants and also a new car seat.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I don't. You know what? I see that as a non-starter from a consumer standpoint, and be like, you know what? From an overweight person's consumer standpoint, because you like go into the dealership and you say, yeah, I'll take the extra large seat.
Well,
versus
it's
the,
already
you know,
an issue. I mean, when you go into a car dealership, you have to try the car on because if you are taller or if you're larger, you're not going to fit in a little Fiat 500. Right. You're not going to fit in an actual Mini Cooper. And those are things you need to take into account. So trying the car on is just as important as trying on new pants.
Fair enough. Thank you. Lisa, do you have something?
Yeah, so...
Lisa just woke up, ladies and gentlemen.
I thought you were asking me something about the car, and I was like, I can't follow that up. That's so well said. Just wrapped up. No, I have something on public health. Woo, my favorite topic.
We're such nerds.
So we're getting into flu season. Yeah. Get vaccinated, everyone. And one of the things that's always, you know, kind of popular in flu season and really fun to watch is the Google flu map.
Oh, right.
You know, where they track searches and try to predict, like, where flu is coming and stuff. And so they redo their algorithm.
Good.
Every once in a while, you know, so, a couple of years they were underestimating, and there were a couple other years they overestimated. And so now they're kind of actually working with some of the CDC data to kind of connect that to theirs, and they redid their algorithm yet again this year. But it was just an article on kind of the different ways that we have started to try to track diseases throughout the internet. So the Google Flu Trends is one of the like older ones and probably one of the more accurate ones there is, but there are some other ones. There was one, so Health Map is one that you can actually track a whole lot of things across the whole world. It integrates data from the International Society for Infectious Disease, the WHO, Google News, and then other things. And this one actually was tracking Ebola. And so they identified an unknown hemorrhagic fever in Guinea, and it actually turned out to be Ebola, and they identified it 9 days before the WHO made the formal announcement. Ooh, wow. So that was one that actually turned out really good. There are some other ones. There's one that just kind of shows the common cold. They just look for really common words that you would see on Twitter and Facebook. So fever, sick, cough, sore throat, and try to identify hot spots for the cold. Hmm. Another one in Chicago is foodborne illness. And these ones, they use Twitter to identify restaurants that might have like violated health codes. So people that tweeted about these restaurants and stuff, they then asked these people to fill out a survey, and then using the results of the survey, mapped them, and city inspectors went to them. This one wasn't quite as good. I guess 16% of the restaurants in these surveys failed inspection, which I guess is kind of a lot. Mm-hmm. 25% passed with critical or serious violations. So I guess, you know, my first thought is like, that's kind of low. Like, it's not like 80%, but at the same time, I don't want 80% of restaurants failing their health code stuff. So that's probably better than, you know, 100% or what something. And then another one is just HIV. And HIV is always a tricky one just because it's a really hard public health thing to catch because people don't want to talk about it.
I think people are tweeting about their...
Yeah, people don't tweet about HIV. Yeah. They don't tweet. You know, it's hard to get into the groups where HIV is really commonly spread and stuff. But this one used, I believe, Twitter. Yeah, I looked at tweets, but instead of like looking at like HIV or something, they looked at tweets that related a behavior that could put someone at risk for HIV. So a sexual behavior, drug abuse, that kind of thing.
They tweet about that?
Apparently some people do.
Have you looked at Twitter?
I don't know.
I try not to.
I haven't tweeted about my cocaine abuse recently.
Oh, no.
So, yeah, just kind of cool ways to really integrate technology in public health.
We, thank you, Lisa. We had an election this past week. I don't know if you noticed.
I tried to forget about
it. We had an election. And so I thought we'd round up how America voted on some health issues this week. Colorado rejected a constitutional amendment that would have modified the state's criminal code to include fetuses under the terms person and child in legal statutes. North Dakota rejected an amendment to the state constitution that similarly would have granted the inalienable right to life of every human being at every stage of development. Tennessee approved a measure that will give legislators more authority to enact, amend, or repeal abortion statutes. Oregon, Washington, D.C., and Alaska all voted to voted for measures that make it legal for adults 21 and up to possess marijuana in varying amounts. Florida, however, refused to legalize marijuana for medical uses. Washington State voted for background checks for all gun sales and transfers, including private ones, and against prohibiting background checks until a federal standard is established. So there were two dueling referendums there. Massachusetts formalized sick time for help for workers, allowing them to accrue up to 40 hours a year at 1 hour for every 30 work. So obviously, it doesn't affect you if you already have sick leave, but everybody apparently gets sick leave. California voted down Proposition 46, which would have raised a cap on malpractice awards and required routine drug and alcohol testing for hospital doctors. Another component of that initiative would have required docs to check prescription drug histories of patients against a state database. So that's where we stand health-wise after the election. No need for further discussion. Just info. News you can use.
Good to know.
Going off of something in there, just a little bit, in terms of what doctors are allowed to do and disclose, there was a story that I originally was going to use as my news piece, but I decided to pass over it. It was from up in Canada, so it doesn't necessarily apply to here, but in a general doctor sense, it does.
Oh, Canada.
Yeah. So, you know, you go into the doctor, it's sometimes a little bit awkward to talk to them and to tell them things or to have them do things to you. That's bad enough. But sometimes, and we experience this as medical students, you have other people in the room, whether they be, you know, other...
I know what you're going to talk about.
Whether they be medical students or visiting doctors or things like that. When all of this combines on the day of your rectal exam, it makes it a little bit more awkward. Fast forward a little ways till after a gentleman up in Canada received his rectal exam in a very full room when he discovered that the people inside of it were not actually other medical professionals that were standing over there in the corner. They were actually people doing research for a television show that's kind of like our Grey's Anatomy up in Canada.
And
that was why they were in there, and he was none too happy about that.
He didn't. My understanding of the story is that he didn't realize right away, but he... ran across, maybe he saw them on television, actually. I think one of them was an actor.
Yes, supposedly.
Saw them on the show and was like, hey, wait just a second. Also, interesting, like, of course, no consent was obtained,
right?
According to what I read. And he alleges that they may actually have participated in the examination. He could feel more than one set of hands on him, quote unquote. So there you go. I hope Saving Hope, the Canadian television show, is just that much more accurate because of this.
That just seems unnecessary.
How realistic do we need to be?
Yeah, exactly.
They can't even get CPR right on these shows. Yeah. You ever watch them do CPR? I mean, geez, it's like, what are you people doing? And I just took CPR as on the Red Cross thing. I'm not even a doctor. They're like, sorry, audio show, but anyway,
hands I don't think go up in the air,
if
but
you could only
maybe.
See
I guess we should say that the show's producers have denied the claim.
Yes, but lawsuit is still going ahead though.
Yes,
so that was
2 years ago that this happened,
right,
to this gentleman.
So the point is, make sure that you disclose things, make sure that, you know, you get consent.
It's interesting that you say that. Actually, in a similar but different vein, I read an article today about doctors disclosing financial conflicts of interest and how it's kind of a new sort of, not a new, but there's a big push recently about it. And
sure.
NPR had an article about how patients feel if they find out after the fact that their doctor had a financial conflict of interest, so receiving any funds from any outside source, and how they feel if it's actually, they feel a lot better about the care they receive if they hear about it first, beforehand. And so, and it said, NPR reported that less than 1% of academic medical centers have a conflict of interest policy. So I decided to look up the University of Iowa's conflict of interest policy, and they have one. So
very strong one.
Yeah, a very strong one. And you can actually look up your physician by last name and all of their conflicts of interest.
I looked up everybody I could think of, and I didn't find too much here.
Yeah, there wasn't. And the ones I saw were very, like, non...
Yeah, they
minimal.
Pretty, yeah,
they
pretty, were pretty minimal, sort of, like, not even really, like, oh, I spoke at this conference. You know.
I think it would be fine if this sort of thing were noted in, like, the waiting room or whatever. Like, or, I mean, I don't see that as a big, you know, problem.
Kind of, you know, it's like interesting putting it on your PowerPoint, you know, second slide.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Slide, yep. Put it in your waiting room.
Well, NPR reported one physician who actually sends out an annual letter to his patients. These are my conflicts of interest. So it's interesting if, you know, there's one, the kind of passive, oh, I'll, you know, submit this form to the administration and they'll update a website, or I'll actively tell my patients, hey, this is what's going on with me. You know, I think it is an interesting dynamic in the doctor-patient relationship, I think. I don't know, just gut reaction could create a better relationship.
Yeah.
You guys, a Brazilian man is probably relieved after having a 2-foot-long lungfish removed from his intestine, but has complained that hospital staff filmed him without his consent, speaking of consent, on their cell phones and posted a video online. The eel-like fish was alive when it was removed. An unverified report says it was 2 feet long. They can grow up to 4 feet, by the way. And the creature later had to be euthanized.
How did this happen?
Oddly, the the report... Thank you for asking the question.
I don't know.
The report did not say how the...
I'm not going to sleep unless I know.
The report did not, unfortunately, say how the fish came to be inside his abdomen.
So it was
good. Fish that is alive.
Maybe he had eggs and it grew? Or
I'm thinking that's not what happened.
Maybe they're wrong.
That
is a hard
fish. I don't know for sure, obviously. But yeah, I'm gonna just
do it. So
let's all just take a moment to picture the act.
Nope.
Use your imagination.
I'm just picturing like it being in my small intestines, like all.
It didn't say small or large.
Are lungfish what, like invertebrates?
I don't think
no. They
they're
the ones that walk on the ground. They're kind of like mud skippers, you know,
but they're
up and flop a little bit.
Right.
I think that's lungfish.
So they have like a skeleton.
Yes, they have a skeleton.
Can you? Oh, I want to see the X-ray.
And they breathe air, but not really.
How
traditionally
cool
they keep water actually in their cheek. So then when they gulp in air, it mixes with the water, and then they use regular gills to get it out of there. So
I watched the video. Doctors can be heard laughing as the fish is surgically removed.
Wow.
According to the story I read, I don't speak Spanish, but the story I read said, one said, this one is for the history, and another says, I have just sent the pic by mail.
Oh.
Other staff are in the background of the video. They're laughing and filming on their cell phones. This took place, I didn't note the hospital, but the dean of the university has now banned the use of cell phones inside surgical centers as a result, which seems
that
was like...
I'm not saying I wouldn't
that
be...
That was banned already.
I'm not saying I wouldn't be tempted if I saw this fish, but like...
I thought you were... Okay.
Uh-huh. No, to pull out my cell phone and be like, oh, this is a crazy, this huge fish. I can't even believe it.
Yeah, but that's
like,
clearly what... I mean, but there were literally like at least 10 people in the OR
just
with their phones out. Like, I don't know.
No.
Poor guy.
Yeah. He's not a happy man.
You have to have the lungfish and then go through all this afterwards.
Yeah.
Like, the lungfish isn't enough.
Yeah.
I think that was pain. I'm just... And it's just boggling my mind. Do you think that hurt? Like, to have it in you?
I'm pretty sure it hurt.
Probably at least uncomfortable. I mean, you don't have...
Greg is showing pictures now.
Of the lungfish. A different lungfish.
Oh, a different lungfish.
A generic lungfish.
Oh.
It's kind of cool.
It's disappointing.
They're quirky little animals.
Maybe he just wanted a pet, and his landlord didn't allow pets.
No. That seems likely. I doubt.
I know, right?
I can think of many better ways to hide a pet from a landlord.
Yeah.
Well, this may bring landlords to start including this question. Do you have a pet inside your body somewhere?
Are they counting microflora? Because we're in trouble.
My little
pet deposit will be awful.
My pets. Oh my goodness. It's good that we have ladies in the room this week.
Is this another uterus story?
Yeah, well, pelvic floor / Kegel exercises are certainly important for women, especially postpartum, for strengthening bladder muscles and preventing prolapse, and parenthetically, perhaps improving sex. There you go. But as with most exercise, motivation is a key. So, London-based startup has opened pre-orders for its connected Kegel exerciser, LV, because that's what we were missing. Internet connectivity with our Kegel exerciser.
I just felt my life
improve.
Sorry,
I couldn't help.
Did you? They call it a wearable because, of course, it's worn inside the body. It has an iOS app that encourages you to do 5-minute workouts, tracks your progress. It's priced at just under $90 US. It contains sensors for acceleration, force, temperature, which means it can be used, because of these many sensors, it can be used in any position, standing, sitting, walking, unlike others that require a static position. It can tell whether the exercise is being done correctly, i.e., as it says in the article, lifting up or rather than pushing down. I don't know much about Kegel exercises. Is this something they teach in medical school? Or
not that I know
of. It's
you guys haven't had your
your
OB lectures yet, I guess. Everybody's looking at me like,
well,
I've heard of them.
Yeah, I don't know about needing an app for that and an actual device. Yeah.
Especially
I hope you can post to Facebook like, oh, I just did my Kegel exercise.
Give it time, and it will be on the iCloud.
It's like you tweet directly from the device.
Twitter.
The run keeper of pelvic floor exercise.
Oh, if they have like a zombie
I just
run
did 45 minutes of Kegels.
Zombie Fitbit. Kegel. Does anybody know the zombie run app?
Yeah.
Yes.
I think this is the definitive sign that app creation has gone too far.
Have we jumped the shark, Corbin?
Jumped the shark. Yeah.
The lungfish.
Oh, so that's all I have for this week. Anybody else have anything they want to bring up?
I found an interesting story about nanotechnology. So there was a researcher in Stuttgart. Is that a place?
Stuttgart.
Stuttgart.
In Germany.
It's where Mercedes Benz.
You know, if you're gonna be on the air, you need to pronounce things in the Stuttgart.
Oh, I'm leaving now. Then there's no chance.
All right, Stuttgart.
That one place in some other country that isn't here.
Yes.
So the researchers made this like tiny like micrometers, I think, scallop prototype thing, and it's made of silicone. They made it in a 3D mold, and it swims like a scallop through your body using magnetic currents.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's tiny enough and light enough that you can put it in your veins, and it can like swim around in non-Newtonian fluids.
That's pretty cool.
So do they induce the current from outside the body, or is it?
I think they would. I don't know if they've tested it in a human, but I know they said it works in non-Newtonian fluids, so blood.
Didn't Google have something about this a couple weeks ago that they wanted to do something where they could put it in your body, and then it would like diagnose things that were
wrong? I forgot about
this. Monitor things.
So maybe they could use this as a jumping off point, because the researcher himself doesn't have any specific plans for like, I'm going to make this measure temperature all the time or anything, but he's hoping to make something that other researchers can base off of and then like use it for whatever cool things that they can think of. Use his model.
A nano pet.
Yes, I challenge our listeners to combine all of the stories we've read about today. Rectal examination, consent with rectal examinations, live fishes inside, pelvic floor, Kegel exercises, and nanotechnology swimming scallops. Combine them all into one thing and make it.
Haiku, perhaps.
No, no. I didn't mean an actual product.
Oh,
yeah.
That's even better.
That
I would also like to hear the haiku version of that. Listener challenge.
Yes. Thank you so much for coming, you guys, today. I had a lovely time, as always. I hope our listeners did, too. Thanks for listening to the Short Code Podcast. Before you go, we'd like to invite you to tell us about your moment of truth. If something strange or wonderful happened to you, if you're annoyed or pleased about something, or if you'd like to say hi to that special basic science professor in your life, leave us a message at theshortcode.com. Do follow us on Twitter so that Cole Chaney can be happy, so you can stay up to date on what's happening at the margins of medicine. The show is made possible by this strange world we live in and a generous donation by Carver College of Medicine student government and the Writing and Humanities Program. Our executive producers are moi, Dave Etler, and Jason Lewis. Our opening theme music is by Dude Skywalker, and our closing theme music is by C2C. We'll see you in 1 week.